week, who knows what we're going to talk. When they wanted to put a schedule on last week, I didn't have one yet, and so, right. So I can only tell you what we did talk about last week. This week, I will tell you what we did talk about when the week is over. And now, tonight, however, I was conned into giving a topic, and it is, how married are you? How many of you are married presently? Raise your hands. Ah, good, sure. Well, that's good. I'm suggesting some alternate topics to our director tonight. Suggested to Elmer that maybe we could put as an alternate topic or another topic or subtitle under this thing, how married would you like to be? And then somebody suggested, how married do you wish you weren't? Or something like that. And I've had times when I wished I wasn't married. Plenty of them. Usually it's when my wife has decided to rearrange the furniture. Because I come in from my little workshop where I specialize in making beautiful sawdust. And I come in from that, and sometimes 2 o'clock in the morning or some such hour, and then she has decided to put the dining room table in the middle of the kitchen floor or something like that, and I bump on it. And at those times, I just can't see any excuse in the world for that woman. She keeps trying to make the furniture, it's 46 years old now, she tries to make it look good, and she's tried for 46 years, and it probably never has looked good until she's going to start now. But she keeps trying, you have to give her that. So that I never know what I'm going to bump into. The worst is when she puts a little table that's supposed to hold a lamp beside the bed, but she puts it at the foot of the bed. And I'm the kind who likes to get up in the middle of the night and make short trips down the hall 4 times. And then my senility gets in the way because I stub my toe or bump on that thing and get really angry, go to the bathroom, come back and hit it on the way back. And a guy should remember longer than that. Well, all right, how married are you? Sometimes my wife and I are very married. Delightfully, gloriously, wondrously married. Unbelievably married, but we're married. And then other times, not quite so. We're going to do a little inventory tonight, and if you find yourself at one of those times when you are gloriously married, you may run high scores. And if you find that it's one of those times when, well, you're tired coming up here and you kind of find some of the irritations that can come in interpersonal relationships getting in your way a little bit, may want to score yourself a little bit lower. Don't let it worry you. Just take it at several intervals for the next couple of weeks and you'll come out on some kind of an average, hopefully. I'm indebted to a doctor, Richard C. Cabot, of the Boston Cabots, for the basic idea in this. Richard Cabot was a very famous doctor and once said near the end of his life that 4 things must be in balance in their appropriate places if life is to be healthy at all. And I'm simply tonight applying this most directly to marriage, but it has to do with, mostly it has to do with us as individuals and how well-adjusted, how balanced, how healthy we are. Cabot said that if work and play are not in some sort of equilibrium or balance, or in their appropriate places at least, have their appropriate weight in life, that there is a great danger and to health. And he was thinking now as an internist, or a doctor of internal medicine. Then he said, love and worship must be in their appropriate and balanced way. We must be in love if we're going to be healthy, he said. Unless you're in love, you run a risk of being quite unhealthy. That's, I like to hear him say that one. That was good, because I have enjoyed love. I have enjoyed it from my parents, and I was in love with them. And I have enjoyed it from my wife, and I am in love with her. There are times she wonders why I don't show it or something, but how that goes after 46 years. You start taking each other for granted, right? Heard that in you guys? Oh, you just take me for granted. Don't think that's too awfully bad. I take it as a kind of a compliment if Gertrude would take me for granted. That simply means she now trusts me, depends on my love and my continued relationship. The bad part of it is that sometimes she needs some strokes or touching or sex or whatever, and I may forget about it, huh? Or vice versa. And I think that's what she means when she says, you're taking me for granted. We have to show it once in a while. Now, the other part of this balance of this love thing is then what I would say is a love affair with God. That's what worship is. Let me put this up here on the board a bit. Let's use this one, just because I got that one ready. Let's put worship at the top and work over here and love. See that? If you can't see it, you can hear it anyway. Now, when Cabot used to talk about this a bit in his last year or two of life, incidentally, Cabot was a fellow who started out as a very famous doctor. I mean, most of his life he's a very, very famous doctor of internal medicine. And then became the dean of a Harvard School of Medicine, but he accepted that job half-time, and he was prestigious enough in the whole medical community, so Harvard said, okay, we'll take you half-time if we can't get you whole-time. They asked him, why in the world do you want it only half-time? They thought maybe to do research, and he said, no, because I would like to pursue an idea. I would like to pursue an obsession, and the obsession was to get clergymen involved as healing people, and more closely related to medical doctors, so they could team up to something called clinical pastoral education. It had its beginnings in Richard Cabot's idea that maybe religion and health ought to be brought together. And you can understand then why I've been saying a few times that Richard Cabot has been very influential in my life. That happens to be the field that I've been in. Cabot taught at Andover Newton Theological Seminary at the same time he's teaching at Harvard, and this is where he ended up his life. He ended up teaching full-time at Andover Newton and resigning from the Harvard faculty. And he taught ethics at the school because that was the only topic that they could feel comfortable about squeaking him in under, but mostly they just wanted him there. And he drove around he had a torticollis, a bent neck, and he drove around like this, and everybody said it was because the windshield of his car was all shattered, and he drove with his head out the window, but that certainly wasn't quite right. His last course was a course on the psychology of dying, and he had the seminar, and it kept going until one day there was an announcement that the class would now meet at Dr. Cabot's home instead of in the classroom. And when he got there, Cabot was sitting in a dressing gown or a robe of some kind, and they said, oh. And he said, well, I wasn't feeling very well today. Then it went on for a few more weeks, and finally it was at his bedside because the man was dying. And he stayed at home and died right there and taught his last class on the psychology of dying about 24 hours before he expired. So committed to helping these students learn something about what that was like. Now, coming back again to this topic. Not so surprising, perhaps, with a man like that, then, that he should say that worship is a love affair with God, or something like that. And that this was essential to health. Cabot was just absolutely committed to the proposition that a love relationship with God in Christ Jesus was essential to health. Now, there are a lot of people who would not agree with that. I'm not sure that I myself would say that there are no healthy people who do not believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. I think I've seen some that were healthier than some of us who do believe in him. But there is no denying to me, and certainly there wasn't to Richard Cabot, that given all other things equal, or anywhere as near, that the relationship with God in Christ adds a zest for living, an understanding of purpose and meaning and significance, a tying in with creation so you feel belonging, and then an awareness that nothing shall be able to separate us from this God with whom we are in love. So there's nothing to fear in death and in dying or in the hereafter. All right, now, let's take a look at work first. When I was doing therapy most of the time, I would sit in this little room and some people would teach me about what it was like to suffer. And very often, I would find myself returning to Cabot's idea of what constituted balance and wholeness and stability in life, because it would keep coming out. I'd find that somebody who was all fouled up in some way or another and having trouble, maybe in marriage, and let's try to keep it that way tonight, if there was trouble between husband and wife, very often we'd find that work got in the way. Often it was salary or income, huh? Money was a factor. We tend to argue a good deal. You ever gotten an argument, you two, about finances? Does that ever get to be any kind of strain? Either that the two of you worry about it together or you worry at each other a little bit about it. My wife can't understand why I need a new lathe every once in a while. She just can't understand it. Her little mixer that she's wanted for 25 years hasn't arrived yet, but but what's that compared with a lathe? You can't make sawdust on a mixer. So we argue a bit about money, and no question but what this does introduce a strain. Now, somehow or another, we have to agree, if we're going to be very married, on how much money is needed. If you take somebody that says, until we get a million, I'm not going to be content. And there are a lot of people like that. And if that person is married to a person who says, until we get a million, I'm not going to be happy, fine, they're married on that item. But if the other person says, oh, come on now, it isn't that important. We don't have to have so much money. There are other values in life, and we can get along very well on less. Somehow or another, you have to get married over money. You have to come together and have some kind of an accommodation, some sort of agreement. And if you don't, you're going to have fights the rest of your life, obviously. Now, the average age around here means you don't have much longer to fight, probably. But even at that, it's kind of important. Now, there are other factors here. Is there any recognition in your work? That says recognition. That is, does somebody come up to you and say, hey, buddy, you did a good job. I really am impressed with what you do. Now, my wife every once in a while says, that I get more recognition than I can handle. And what happens is some of it turns out in ego. And she thinks that a little of that extra recognition that I might get because of my lifestyle or something ought to spill off on her, so I'd say, honey, that was a great cake you made tonight. But I take her for granted, so I seldom say it. So she gets less recognition. And I think this is a complaint of a lot of women, that the man stands out there more visible, and the wife stays somewhat back, and then gets less recognition. Man, how starved you can get if you're not recognized for what you're doing. You can just get terribly starved. Then that gets into the marriage mix. You better find a way to balance out recognition factors if the tensions are going to be reduced in marriage and you're going to enter into more of the joy of it. Now there's something even more important than recognition, that's satisfaction. Recognition is what other people tell you about how you're doing. Satisfaction is what you tell yourself about what you're doing. That's even more important. You've all been in circumstances, haven't you, where somebody's come up and said, oh, wonderful, I'm so impressed with what you're doing. But down inside there's that rankling, gnawing thing that says, it wasn't a very good job that I did. So regardless of how I con them into thinking it was all right, I know better. Now there are times that gets to be a disease and a person just manufactures that bad feeling because they're masochistic and they don't want to feel good anyway. But we ought to have a healthy awareness of when we do well and do well often enough at whatever level, whatever we're capable of and whatever field we're operating in, so that we can say when we go to bed at night, hey, this was a good day, I did a job, I did it fairly well, and I'm happy and I'm proud of it. Whether or not anybody else said that, it's better if you get both of these things together. Now, the hours that you work make a difference. There are guys that go to the office or to the shop or whatever, well, mostly it's the office, I think they're where this sort of thing shows up, and they work 10 hours a day or 11 hours a day, too little time with the wife, too little time with the family. The kids get somewhat neglected because, you know, the work comes first. The work may come first because they want more money. The work may come first because they're workaholics. You know, there's an obsessional, addictive factor. And they have to work or they go nuts. We'll get to some of that on the other side, on the play side, here a little while ago, to show where some of the balance of that comes. But if for instance, work is taking up too many hours of the day, then other values are diminished, aren't they? And are backed off. That's bad news. The old saying, man works from sun to sun, woman's work is never done, isn't all that inappropriate even today, because even though everything is so much different, we've rescheduled so much. Mothers, particularly, I suppose, young mothers with youngsters, the work kind of keeps on going in spite of all your new gadgets that drive me crazy sometimes when you get washing machines and dryers and Mixmasters and Cuisinarts and vacuum cleaners, and I have to wait for that new lathe that I think I ought to have. But I haven't noticed that my wife is any less busy today with that stuff than she was a long time ago before we had it. Somehow or another, women's lives tend to get filled up with a lot of work in one way or another. Today, I like this idea that women are now finding themselves able to go out and do some other things around. I think in the long run, this is going to be very healthy. I think at the moment it is getting exaggerated in its importance, in its, or when it becomes almost obsessional, it may defeat itself. But I know I just lost half the crowd. But I think that sometimes we overstate things in order to end up correcting a deficiency. Huh? Maybe we're somewhat at that place on careers. If you don't have a career, you can't be alive. You can't be, you know, as a woman, you can't be. Otherwise, you're just a slave to the dishes or something. I think that maybe there's something of an overstatement. Or you can ask yourself if you think there is. Frankly, I haven't had any experience with it because Gertrude doesn't have a career. But the hours that you put in on this thing are extremely important. The balance so that one person doesn't work way too much and one way too little, this gets to be very important. There has to be a trading off, and if the wife is working, then of course it makes some sense that the husband picks up the broom or the dish towel or whatever also, huh? Maybe we're getting over some of the threat to our masculinity on that bit, and maybe we're only making it a kind of an additional battleground. I don't know. It depends on each of us, perhaps. But it is extremely important that we can balance out these hours so that other values in life may be maintained. Now, you'll notice before we're through that there are five sections to each one of these. Now, for the life of me, I can't remember what the fifth one is. So, who cares? Let's go over to play. Doesn't make any difference. I just put it in there to keep it balanced. It's symmetrical. I start with the word alone. Can you play alone? Or do you have to have others? If you can't play alone, there's a question of whether you can play together with anybody. Let me put together here because I'm playing these two off at the same time. And I'm talking now in this setting, man and wife and family, that can put together part. What happens if, for instance, sometime you have got some time off, an hour, 2 hours, half a day, a week, whatever, you got some time off, and you really would like to indulge in some kind of recreational pursuit for a while, but there's nobody around, then I think you're impoverished. And this is one of the common afflictions of our culture and of our civilization. That we don't know how to be alone and enjoy it. Three times this week I've quoted Santayana, one of my favorite poems, mostly because it's kind of a rationalization and justifies some of the things I do. Where Santayana says, "My heart rebels against my generation. That speaks of freedom and is slave to riches. And toiling neath each day's ignoble burden boasts of tomorrow." Then these lines. "No time for noonday rest nor midnight watches." You ever sat out just all by yourself at night and just sat? I'm not saying now stand out there with a telescope until some horrible hour like 3 o'clock in the morning. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm saying just sit out there until 3 o'clock in the morning. Not to look at the stars, unless that's incidental, but just to be there. Can you enjoy being alone? Really enjoy being alone. With nothing to work on, nothing to plan, nothing to listen to, nothing to read, but just to enjoy being. And I'm submitting that if you can't enjoy being, then you can't enjoy the doing of play or of the work or anything else. It is essential to health. I once had a graduate level seminar. Guys came in from around the country for a 3-month thing in the summertime. first assignment, well, I gave a whole bunch of stuff, some books and things that I ought to read, because professors always like to punish their students by giving them assignments. But I did have the decency to get at something essential, and I said, now, before you start reading any book, before you turn in any papers to me on these things, I have an assignment for you. I want you to sit 2 hours doing absolutely nothing. And that was a little puzzling. What do you mean doing nothing? One of them said. And I could see the anxiety level start to creep up right away. Nothing, that's the last thing we want to do. Nothing. Something, that's easy to live with, but nothing, that's harder. Because that leaves me with myself. And if I don't really like me well enough to be alone with me, well, how in the world can I like think anybody else is going to tolerate me, huh? And yet we tend to play off on that one. But anyway, these students started raising questions. Well, now, do you mean sit and listen to music or something like that? No music. Books? No. Well, could we be thinking about the next Sunday sermon or whatever it was that they might want to get at? No, just sit there. Let the mind be as blank as it wants to be, because that's when it gets full. It doesn't get full when it's focused. It gets full when it's opened. Open to some kind of a relationship. Maybe this is what the psalmist was saying. Be still and know that I am God. God, big God, tremendous God, universal God. Only in stillness and quietness do you ever really relate to Him. That's when it happens. In the stillness and the quietness where you let God be God, and you don't need golf clubs to do it. Golf is a horrible, sinful game, but the way I play. If we could only develop the capacity, the skills of solitude, we would be much healthier as individuals, and certainly much healthier as a society. And we wouldn't have to go chasing all the way over to Asia to pick up some gurus to come back and teach us a little bit about meditation. Now, meditation is a strong theme biblically. How strong is it in your life or in your church? I think it's neglected for most of us. One of those students that got this assignment didn't send me a single paper until 3 months after the course. And he said, I finally made it, 2 hours. And then felt that it was a wondrously emancipating experience. But we have to fill up, don't we, our hours, our days, our moments with things. Usually we need golf clubs or boats or something to implement this playing also. But what if you don't have those? But if you can find the deepest, most significant joy and excitement of living by just being for a few minutes or for an hour or for a day or for whatever. And it's a little bit like Emerson said, about riches or wealth. He said, we are rich in direct proportion to the number of things we've learned to do without. If you don't need anything, you're wealthy. If you've got 10 billion bucks, like Getty or somebody, but you need 10 more, man alive, you're $10 billion impoverished, right? I don't think I'm ever going to hit the point where I don't need anything, and therefore I'm entirely rich. But it's fun to kind of work at it a bit. Retirement on Social Security may scare the wits out of people. It did me. For a while. I even moved across the whole 2/3 of the United States to get someplace where that Social Security and a $325 pension from the church would keep me alive, only to find that I'm the richest I've ever been. Because there's a fantastic river flowing in front of my house and there are good friends around. And the sky is more beautiful because I have a chance to look at it now. And I didn't have then. And I am a wealthy man. Wealthier than I have ever been. Women, clouds were getting in the way of the thing, and I was sitting there and couldn't even look at the stars. So I was just sitting there and said, why am I happy? Here I am, all alone. The stars are all cluttered up with clouds, and I'm cold. And somewhere or another, it felt great. That sort of a warm feeling, how do you describe it? You can't describe it by temperature, but you've all experienced it. Times when you just feel good. The feeling part of life has been disparaged so much in our culture that we're almost embarrassed to just feel good. We want to accomplish. We want to be successful. We want to do. We want to act. But just to be and to feel. The price tag has been put pretty low on those things, but they are essential to health and to well-being. If we are a handicapped generation, and I think to some extent we are, a part of the handicap is because we haven't learned to be. We don't even have the courage to be, do we, to borrow the Tillich's term, I guess. We don't have the courage to be. So we do instead, we act instead. Now obviously you've got to do some acting or this world is going to fall apart. Somebody has to be responsible for some producing of things, huh? So don't take me too seriously on some of these things. All I'm trying to do is bring in a little balance into the equation. So if I don't talk enough about accomplishing and doing and being, doing and accomplishing things out there, keep in mind what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say something about the neglect of being in favor of doing. To get out at the existence instead of essence of life. We ought to get at the essence to bring it into balance. To know who we are, and what we are, and why we are, and to know that He is God, and to be able to sit alone some daytime or nighttime, even in a crowd. And when the storm of, you know, all kinds of things are whirling around us, activity, cars racing up and down the freeways, people going frantic trying to act out and be or to do, that somehow or another we find an eye of the storm into which we can retreat and just sit. Even in the most frenzied world, the Christian should be able to find that eye of the storm. And it isn't impossible to accomplish because we were created. We were created to with a capacity for this. It just gets beaten out of us. Try to recapture it. Right here in October, 4 years ago, we had a group of about 25 young people, college age or just beyond, that came. And when they first came in, the first day that we started the little course, I asked each of them to spend the last half of the 3-hour period that we had together in the morning going out and staking out claim on 1 cubic yard of Holden. They were to go out and find a place, preferably out just a bit and away, and to say, this is my place now and I'm going to come here, and they had to spend 2 hours in it every day to complete the assignments for this one. 2 hours in which hopefully they could experience the joy, the recreational value of being alone. Well, there was a whole lot more than that, because from that they could see the stars at night, huh? From that cubic yard. From that they could feel the ground underneath them and maybe remember that into this dust I shall one day return. Maybe they ought to pat it a little bit and get acquainted. Hey, buddy, we're going to be together for a long time, you know. Tell me something about yourself, this dirt, this ground, so I can know you before I get dumped into you. It was out of this dust that we were taken, out of the stuff of creation, out of the very dust of it all. We were formed as a race of beings. The species, and then also it's to this that we are going to return. I think those meanings that sometimes are pronounced over the casket when we depart this life, out of the dust thou came, unto the dust thou shalt return, and out of this dust you shall rise again, they ought to be lived with a little bit more before we die with them, huh? So we understand it a little bit more. Then maybe we can do what some of the older people of a generation or five generations back and way back, come soothing death, come blessed repose, instead of sitting around dreading it all. Holy smokes, we're not even going to begin it. Let's go. Alone, if you can't play alone, you can't play together. How would you like to live with somebody who can't stand himself? See, you can't even love another person unless you love yourself. Jesus made that clear, and we've knocked that out of shape ever since it was said, because we don't quite want to believe it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Is that right? Well, does that mean, because I think religious people have tended, particularly Christian people, have tended to say, well, we're supposed to hate ourselves. Jesus just simply made it, he could have stated axiomatically and said, you will love your neighbor as yourself. That's exactly the way you'll love your neighbor. And if you hate yourself, you're going to project that out, and it's going to interfere with every your relationship. If you hate yourself, sure as can be, you're going to project that out. That's what Hausman was talking about when he said that in every eye on London streets, he saw somebody who hated him. Until they die, they each must look at me and wish me ill. Well, of course they didn't. Most of them just ignored him. Most of them didn't even know him, but didn't pay attention to him. But he felt it because he was bouncing it out and getting it back from their eyes. Does it take a whole lot of gadgetry? You know, that's a part of this being alone. Now, another thing here we have to hasten on a bit is hobby. Do you have a hobby? You should start a hobby when you're 30. One or two or three. Experiment with a few until you get some that you really can live with for a long time, the rest of your life. So you develop the skills of the hobby. It's a tough thing to come to retirement and find it's a vacuum because you have no idea of anything that you'd like to do from now on. You've enjoyed your work, but now retirement pulls the rug out from underneath you and you walk into a vacuum. But hobbies, if they are well developed and carefully trained into us over a long period of time, can give us something significant and meaningful to do so that retirement and these ever earlier times of retirement can be welcomed because, wow, now I've got some time to do things that I've been planning for all my life. Now, whatever it is, I'm glad to see volunteering, for instance, develop into larger movements around the country. But then you ought to have developed some skills ahead of time in volunteering, working with special kinds of people that someday you may be able to devote full time to. As a hobby, this is recreational. I'm not talking about play now, like marbles or jacks. I'm talking about recreation, recreational. There must be a hobby. I'm just going to have to drop this to get at some other things in the interest of time. I'm such a disciplined guy that I always come out exactly right at the last minute, but with three-fourths of it not said. Love. What about love? Do you love yourself? That's number one. As we say, if you don't love yourself, for goodness sakes, don't marry somebody. Because you're just going to be living in a battleground for the rest of the time. If you don't love yourself, and now, obviously, the corollary of that is that if you do love yourself, then there can be some real togetherness in love. Let's just put this spouse here for the time being. Do you really love your spouse? The answer is yes and no. I think for most of us, isn't it? Sometimes, or most of the time, or all of it, almost all of the time, the answer comes something like that. But I don't think I love my wife all the time. Or sometimes she just doesn't deserve it. She hasn't told me this too many times, but there are a few times I think she feels the same about me. On the other hand, the momentum of love in our lives carries us across some of that, bridges, like some kind of a bridge across a roaring torrent down there, and makes it possible to cross the other side where we've got our arms around each other again. Sex. Great stuff. You remember when you were 15, 16, 18, and you thought, man alive, better use this. Impatient, huh? Because you had some kind of an idea that it was a fleeting kind of a thing. Talked to a 90-year-old man the other day and said, he was saying with a twinkle in his eye, oh yeah, wow, when I mentioned we got into the topic of sex. your patterns are a little different, and the timing is a little different, and the obsessional part of it are a little different. But when you were born, sex was a gift, and it stays with you until you die, even though the expressions may change a bit. One of the wonderful things about our day is that it has become obsessed with sex. Again, this is an overstatement that has helped to correct a deficiency. There are people, well, when I first came out of some graduate school in psychology, I can remember working with a large number, the high percentages now, percentage-wise, with women who were in what was called an involutional melancholia. After the menopause, depression. You see very little of this anymore, just because you women have caught on that this isn't the end of life. You're still going to be attractive. You're still going to be sexually attractive. And there's no time to just sort of resign from that phase of activity in life. Remember speaking to a bunch of seminary wives one night in a little class I used to have for them, and my daughter's face, my daughter happened to be in the class because she was married to a seminary student, and I got on to talking about, you know, sex at 60, and I saw my daughter's face beam a bit, and then she started to giggle, and it was a disturbance. I almost went over and slapped her. So afterwards, I got a hold of her, and she said, wow, I've always suspected it of you and Mom, but I didn't know for sure. So you love others. Now by others, I mean not just yourself or your spouse, but do you love others? And I'm not saying your next door neighbor or the people who are lovable or the people who are near you or the people who have loved you. But how about the stranger? How about the hungry? The nameless, faceless hungry. Through television, they're becoming a little more known to us, aren't they? We see their faces a bit. But we see a face here and a face there, and there are tens of millions of them. Love doesn't really, the capacity to love has no boundaries to it. It doesn't mean love those within 15 feet of you or or within the same house or within the same town. But if this world is going to ever hold together, love has to be expressed long distance and not just in local calls. And we sure better get at it, because time is very late. It'll get straightened out, but it has to get straightened out the hard way if we don't do it the right way. If we're not willing to love sacrificially and effectively and intelligently now, then it will be done in this hectic, crazy, frenzied, revolutionary way that gets so terribly destructive. Some of us were talking today, and I was suggesting a wild idea that I suppose is impractical as can be, but I would guess that most of the practical ideas have been tried, and we ought to get at some impractical ones, or some. What would happen if the President of the United States went before the United Nations and said, we're admitting as a nation that we haven't been as concerned about the people of this world as we ought to, specifically now about El Salvador, and we have decided to announce to the world that we have been wrong and neglectful of it. Now, from now on, no more money for any military things at all, regardless of the threats from Cuba or Russia or anybody else. Just no more military support. We've already learned, if nothing else, that it hasn't done us any good down there. But we're going to take the same amount of money or even double that money and announce this. It has to be done in, say, United Nations or someplace, so it's wide open and right out front. We're going to double that amount of money, and it's going to go into land reform and into the relief of poverty and into bringing our best possible brains down here to help show what crops can be produced in larger nutritional ways in a hurry. What do you think the effect would be in Central America? I think I know. If I know the people, and I've slept on the floors of their schools and their churches and a lot of nights when we're running little clinics, I think that they would say to anybody else that wants to come in there and try to fan the breezes of discontent and of military approach, say from Cuba or from Russia, they would say, hey, you guys, get out of here and fast. We'll fight you hard. Because they would rather be it related to the United States down there than they would to anybody else. But if they have to find food, if they have to find decency, they're going to get it some way and from somebody. And I would like to be around to see the miracle that would happen, I think. Somebody was impractical enough to do something like this. Well, unless we start loving others outside of ourselves, long-distance loving, loving the unknown, loving the people we've never met, but loving them because we know there's hunger and there's suffering and there's injustice out there. If we don't do that, we're in kind of a bad way. Let's jump up above. Obviously, there are other things, others that way. Let's put five things in here and we'll hit two or three. First thing I would ask about your worship, your love, to evaluate now. How is your love affair with God as far as feeling is concerned? Does it involve awe? I question faith. Well, I better define faith. I think faith may be defined as a relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. That is Christian faith. It isn't a set of what we believe about Him. It isn't series of statements or creeds about how he behaves or how we should behave in his presence or anything. It starts simply. We are living in faith if we are related to God in Christ. If that is not present, it doesn't make any difference what we believe about him. There are only some kind of definitions. Now, how in the world can you stand in the presence of the living God and then get analytical about it and say, well, this is the way it is, and this is the way it is, and this is the way it is? Awe is the basic religious emotion, not only Christian emotion. It is the basic religious emotion. It's hard to define religion unless it's defined importantly on the base of the experience of awe. I used to delight in being exposed to primitive cultures and to see their enormous capacity for awe. Stood one night watching a moon with a bunch of Chippewa Indians in southern Ontario. I knew them quite well, totally unprepared for finding that everything quieted down one night, and they all stood up and walked down to the lake shore. And the place quieted down, the kids start running around, and the dogs stopped barking even. And I followed them down to the lake shore and stood right behind them. Something was going on I couldn't understand. But it was kind of fun staying there anyway, because down the lake, way down there, there was a glow in the sky and the moon was starting to come up. You know, some nights when that moon looks so enormous, you know, it looks like it's 80 times as big as what it does in the middle of the night. Just enormous. Then I started to hear people whisper, kind of, Jesus, Jesus. And I couldn't understand what they were saying. I thought they were looking down the lake to see a canoe come. After a while, the spell kind of diminished, and we walked back up and got back up by the little teepees that they were living in the summer encampment. And then I leaned to my mentor, an old lady, and asked her what this meant. Jesus. Jesus, what is it? Jesus. The moon. They had seen that moon a thousand times as often as I had, huh? They lived right out underneath it. But there was the mystery and the awe that comes out of the mystery and awe of a creation, but so closely related to their basic religious expressions. Is there something wrong if we go to church Sunday after Sunday, 52 Sundays a year, and we never feel experience the numinous, experience the caught-upness, the awe, the dread even, which is a part of awe, isn't it? The mystery? Or do we go to church to run through a nicely run liturgy and hear a theologically sound dissertation? Some are not. We must learn to stand close enough to God so that we feel this caught-upness, or we die as far as faith and life in him is concerned. All right. Is there a kind of a consciousness of God? Do you live out your days conscious of his presence? Are you like Tevye? Remember Tevye? Huh? Fiddler on the Roof? Remember how he looked up that way every once in a while? See what I mean? And he'd go about things, you know, and then every once in a while something would come up and he'd say, you see what I mean, don't you? He was constantly aware that God was there. Oh, I wish I could be Tevye. I would. Conscious. What would you sacrifice? What would you give up for it? Your way of life? If that was necessary. Oh, I can go on and on. Now, if these things are in some balance so that you and your spouse hold, put proper or equal weights on it, the chances are you're getting along all right. If there are serious disparities in any of these, chances are that you're having a rough time. And you ought to work at it a bit. And we're going to be late.